It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 496 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, May 21st, 2017. I am the Sala Monster. Allergies are kicking my ass, so I don't feel very well today. But here we are. I feel a lot better than some other people who passed away this week, unfortunately. Chris Cornell, that was a pretty terrible thing to hear about. Chris Cornell, the frontman for Audioslave, and a lot of you probably know him from Soundgarden, only 52 years old. He died this week, hung himself after a concert. I think it was in Chicago. Was it in Chicago or Detroit? I think it might have been in Michigan, but he was found dead or unresponsive and later was declared dead. They found him in his hotel room. I guess he had some kind of band around his neck. Suicide by hanging is the cause of death, although I guess the family says that they don't buy that it was an intentional suicide. He was on some sort of prescription medication that they think he may have been suffering a side effect. It warped his mind. Who knows? Either way, it's very sad. Only 52. Very talented guy. I was a big Audioslave fan back in the day. Not really as familiar with Soundgarden. I know who they are, obviously, but you know, Audioslave, I remember when I first got my very first MP3 player, there were a bunch of Audioslave songs that I had on there. They were some of the first songs I think I even put on there. You know, and it was, you know, Like a Stone. I used to love watching the music video for Like a Stone. I still think it's actually very, very good. Shadow on the Sun, I Am the Highway, Show Me How to Live. I mean, I was a fan of their music and his voice. And again, 52 is way too young for anybody to pass away, especially for it to happen that way. It's a real shame. And also, got to mention the death this week of pretty boy Doug Summers, to kind of turn this back around to wrestling. 65, which is also still fairly young. I don't know that there is a cause of death that has been issued, but he was part of some classic matches with Playboy Buddy Rose. It was the two of them against the Midnight Rockers, Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty back in the AWA. You know, some really classic matches they had that really helped put Shawn and Marty on the map. Some bloodbaths that they had. I know he sued WWE a number of years ago over some sort of royalties situation. I guess they weren't compensating him adequately, or if at all, for footage of those old AWA matches, and the case got thrown out and he lost. And that was the last I had ever heard of him. I hadn't heard anything about him, positive or negative, since he lost that case until this week when he passed away. So, unfortunately, add another wrestler to the list of the deceased this year. It's a growing list, and we're not even 6 months into the year. Thank you for all of the positive feedback to Mama Monster's appearance last week. I have to tell you, it was overwhelming. I thought people would get a kick out of it. It's nice to do something different like that every now and then. And it just felt perfect. You know, Mother's Day, let's, you know, get her on the show. Nobody's ever really heard from her. You've heard me talk about her before, but to actually put a voice to the name and universal praise, to the point where I think people probably enjoy her more than me at this point. In fact, I got an email from her earlier in the week when I was telling her about some of the feedback that was pouring in. And she sends me an email back. She goes, "Oh, it seems like I'm more popular than you." And I'm like, I think all the comments have gone to her head. So we have to dial that back a little bit. You might just say, I created a monster. Right? See what I did there? Actually, I guess technically it would be more correct to say that she created a monster in a more literal sense, but we'll have her back on at some point. A lot of you guys, oh, you got to get her back on the show. You got to give her a weekly segment. I'm not going to do that, but we'll definitely have her back on the show. I was also taken aback by all the mentions of her accent. I guess it's just because I have been listening to her for so many years and I've been around her for so long that I don't notice. I mean, I notice little things about the way she pronounces certain words, but I had one person write in telling me that my mother sounded like Enzo Amore. I don't know what that person was listening to, but if my mother started sounding like Enzo Amore, she and I would have to learn sign language to communicate with each other, because there's no way I could listen to that all the time. So I wouldn't go quite that far. But yeah, I got a lot of comments about that too. So I just want to say thank you, because it also made her feel really good. I know it put a smile on her face, not just mine. So again, I'm very grateful to everybody who sent in feedback. If you didn't hear it, by the way, episode 495, you can go back. It's later on in the show. I had her on for about half an hour, probably 25, 30 minutes. We did some trivia. It was a fun time. So you can go back in the archives and check that out. If you want to take advantage of the Audible offer that we still have going for listeners of The Sound Off, all you got to do is punch in audibletrial.com/Solomonster. That is the magic URL. You go through the sign-up process. They will let you sample the service free for 30 days. That's an entire month that you can browse around, see if it's the sort of thing you might like. The cool thing about it is you get one free book you get to cash in on during that trial, and even if you cancel the trial so you don't get billed, that book belongs to you. And a lot of you have taken advantage of that. You've cashed in on the A.J. Lee book, Crazy Is My Superpower. You've cashed in on other books, The Hardcore Truth by Bob Holly. Brock Lesnar's book is up there. Daniel Bryan, Stone Cold, Steve Austin, Hulk Hogan. Tons and tons of wrestling books. Again, any week now, the Justin Roberts book I know is going to be up there as well. I have not finished it. I was talking to Justin the other day because we're going to try to get him on the show soon. And I'm not done with the book, but what I've read so far, really good stuff. And if you want to get a real inside look at what it's like to work for WWE, it's an honest read. And it's kind of eerie how I can relate to a lot of what I'm reading there. He and I are a lot alike in some ways. So I'm really digging the book so far. I'm not done, but I highly recommend it. And anyway, audibletrial.com/Solomonster is the link to punch in. I don't know when Justin's book will be up there. He was telling me, I mean, the audiobook, it's done. It's kind of frustrating because he can't get answers. It's kind of in the hands of Audible. I don't know why they're holding it. So just keep checking if that's something you're interested in. But definitely take advantage of the offer. You get a free book. You help the podcast out. It's a win-win situation. And thank you to everybody who has already done so. And also, let's do PayPal roll call here, because you guys are what power this thing every single week. If you want to make a voluntary PayPal donation to The Sound Off, you can very easily do so on the Solomonster.com. Right-hand side of the page, you'll see the PayPal button. $10 or more, we'll get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. Thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Adam the Maniac Massaglia. Have not heard from Adam in quite a while. Radiant Ray Wrighton, RJ, who sent a very nice photo the other day of her sporting a Sound Off shirt on Twitter. I love when I see photos like that. Mass Grave, Micah Harshaw. Michael Maximum Pain Palkowski. Lionheart Michael Paez. Luis Hercules Hernandez. The Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker. Capital Carnage, Christian Reyes, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, The Chin Crusher, Karsten Axe, Tony the Terror Liefert, Destruction Jamie Dorsch, The Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Real Rock and Roller Ryan Hodge, Smash Mouth Thomas Cochran, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, The Maniac Messiah, Kaleem Jameson, sorry, I was going to say Johnson. Kaleem Jameson, The A-Train of Disdain, Adam Morales, The Gold Standard, Jeremy Law, Bored Vegas, got a thing, Bored Vegas, and finally here, Oscar Oofman Fernandez, who is celebrating his one-year anniversary with his girlfriend Jenny at the Mets game today. The Mets are having a good weekend for a change. I will be at Citi Field myself on Thursday night for the Padres game, so have fun. And thank you to everybody who has made a donation. We've got backlash predictions for the pay-per-view. There is a pay-per-view tonight. They're back in Chicago as they were last night. I got a review of last night's NXT TakeOver special from Chicago, which was an excellent show. Some thoughts on the WWE United Kingdom Championship special from Friday. Randy Orton hates dives. Cameron hates black guys. So much stuff to dive into here. We'll start with Backlash predictions, since I want to get this out of the way first. This is only hours now away from the pay-per-view. And as I go along here, I'll incorporate some thoughts from SmackDown on Tuesday. I'm not going to do a formal, you know, a whole big SmackDown review at this point. It's kind of pointless. But they are live from Chicago, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of CM Punk chants. You didn't hear a lot of it last night, but I have a feeling that you probably will hear more of it tonight. If I had to venture a guess, I'm sure they'll be out in full force. SmackDown Twitter poll, by the way, from last Tuesday, over 1,500 of you voted. 54% thumbs up, 46% thumbs down. That is, I believe, the closest, or one of the closest poll results for a SmackDown show that we've had in quite some time. A lot of weeks, SmackDown 70-30, 80-20, a lot of love is shown to SmackDown. I would even argue that might be a little high, but it's kind of narrowing, right? The gap is narrowing there, so SmackDown not quite as beloved as it might have been a few weeks ago. Jinder Mahal on that show got a win over AJ Styles, which, you know, made sense, given that Jinder's the one going for the championship tonight. And he got the win, albeit with an assist from Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens was out there, and he factored into the finish. I will say this much, they have done all that they can since he became number one contender to try to make Jinder out to be something special. I speak for myself in this, at least in my case, I'm not buying it. It hasn't really worked for me. I could see them putting the effort in. They're trying, but I'm not convinced. The Usos are 2 for 2 in the promo department heading into the show tonight. Another great one here they cut on Tuesday on Breezango. To the point that when it was over, I wanted to cheer them and not Breeze and Fandango, who were supposed to be the baby faces. That's how good that their promo work has been over the last few weeks. We did get a contract signing. It was not with Orton and Jinder, though. Remember all those weeks ago? I said, all right, they have 4 weeks to build Jinder Mahal up as a believable contender for the championship. And you never know. Sometimes all it takes is one really riveting contract signing segment. I know we don't see too many of those. That's not a word you normally associate with a contract signing, right? Riveting. But maybe Jinder would go out there and blow us all away with a great promo. I have yet to hear a great Jinder Mahal promo. I tend to enjoy Jinder more when I hear him speaking as a normal human being, right? I've seen him a couple of times on Talking Smack. Very down to earth, just like a normal person. I've enjoyed that. I heard part of his interview with Chris Jericho a few weeks ago on Talk is Jericho. I'm listening to this guy going, hey, I like this guy. Right, but the promo stuff that he's done so far, I'm not impressed. But they didn't do a contract signing with the two of them. They did a contract signing instead with the women. It broke down. Shane McMahon made a match between Carmella and Naomi, non-title. Carmella won with a schoolgirl, so that would seem to set her up as the next challenger for the championship. I did see one, I forgot which side it was on, but there was something floating around that was you know, saying that Carmella originally was earmarked to win the championship at WrestleMania, and then plans changed. So it sounds to me like Carmella may be getting the championship soon. She may be the next one in line to hold that title. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But she obviously has positioned herself now as the number one contender. Dolph Ziggler had a segment on that Go Home SmackDown talking about how he doesn't understand all the hype behind Shinsuke Nakamura. So basically, you know, he sounds like someone in our Facebook group. Be kind of funny if Ziggler was a lurker in the group. He said he did his homework and he put together a highlight reel for us of Nakamura's accomplishments since coming to WWE, which turned out to be a blank screen with no footage. And then he showed highlights of his own career, which only drove home for me how sad this guy's downfall has been. Main event had Randy Orton beating Baron Corbin. Great finish. I have to give them credit for that. Corbin ran at Orton. Orton ducked. Corbin slid out of the ring, quickly spun around the post, slid right back into the ring, and right into an RKO for the pin. I thought that was great. Jinder came out, cut a dull promo. Singh Brothers attacked Orton. He fought them off, but Jinder laid him out with the Cobra Clutch Slam, and he posed with the championship to end the show. I'm happy they tried someone kind of new in this spot. It's just not working. Now, I did say when this whole thing started, part of me kind of hoped that he would beat Orton for the belt at Backlash, because babyface champion Randy Orton is about as exciting as a colonoscopy. But Jinder is, I don't think Jinder is the guy. I just don't buy him as the guy. Now, Rusev, on the other hand, I feel like I could get behind Rusev. Not that he's been booked that much better than Jinder was going into this whole thing, but here's what I would do. Let Orton win tonight and go heelish for a match with AJ Styles at SummerSlam. Or just put the damn title on Rusev. If you're going to put the title on somebody new and try to make a new star on SmackDown, use someone like Rusev. Give him a chance to run with the championship, right? I find Rusev very entertaining. For a while there, I mean, he went undefeated for what, a year? Over a year? He was the U.S. champion, had that big match with John Cena at WrestleMania. I think that Rusev could actually work in a top role like that, or at least deserves an opportunity if you're looking to make somebody new. I just feel like I can't say the same for Jinder. Not that they can't push Jinder as an upper mid-card guy. I'm not saying just slide him back down to Jobberville, USA. But I don't buy him in this role. And we know Rusev is coming back. In fact, I will get into the predictions here. I wouldn't be surprised if he made an appearance at the pay-per-view tonight. He was supposed to be on the show Tuesday and he wasn't there. So we'll talk about that when I get to the main event. By the way, Picture in Picture. It's coming to SmackDown very soon with the commercials. They tried this on an episode of SmackDown last year. I'm pretty sure it was a one-shot deal. They never tried it again, but I guess it must have done well because USA is bringing it back permanently, which means that when SmackDown cuts to an ad break, you will still get to see the live action on the screen in one box, and the commercials will air in another box. I think it's a smart move. What I found interesting in this broadcasting and cable story where the news broke, was they had a list of the top 10 companies who pay for ad time on SmackDown so far this year. WWE Network, not surprisingly, the biggest spender, over $700,000, followed by Taco Bell, Verizon, The Real Cost, which I think are those anti-tobacco ads, Nutrisystem, Universal Pictures, Domino's, Geico, Burger King, and Subway. No car commercials. No car commercials. Imagine that. Luxury brands don't want to spend money on WWE programming. All right, Backlash tonight. The kickoff match is Ty Dillinger against Aiden English. I'm going to go with Ty Dillinger as my pick. Luke Harper against Eric Rowan, which was announced on Talking Smack. A very interesting segment with Eric Rowan on Talking Smack last Tuesday, where I heard more from him than I think I have his entire WWE career. Normally he just walks around with a sheet mask on his face. That was a very bizarre segment. Makes me think that maybe that is some kind of a sign that they intend to do something with him, because I've heard more from Rowan recently than I have from Harper. So I'm going to go with Eric Rowan. I'm going to pick him to go over here in this match. Baron Corbin against Sami Zayn. I'm going with Baron Corbin. Probably not the last time we'll see these two in the ring together. I suspect we'll get at least one more match between them. But unless it's some kind of a fluke, Sami ain't beating him straight up. I think that's pretty obvious. But I still think Corbin's going to win. We have the welcoming committee. Natalya, Carmella, and Tamina taking on Charlotte, Naomi, and Becky Lynch. I got my fingers crossed that this is all just a ruse and Charlotte is not going babyface, and perhaps even tonight she'll turn on her partners, or there'll be some sort of dissension in the ranks and it leads to the finish. Probably Naomi getting pinned. But I'm going with Natalya, Carmella, and Tamina for the win. We have Dolph Ziggler against the debuting Shinsuke Nakamura. I think it's safe to say Nakamura is getting the win here. He's not losing in his first match. The Usos defend their SmackDown Tag Team titles against Breezango. I saw Tyler Breeze on Twitter yesterday posted, "Hey, you know, guys, I don't know if you realize how important this match is to us, how big this is for us." So this is a big deal for them. I think that's very cool. I think that they have gotten the, certainly in my opinion, I was always a Tyler Breeze fan in NXT. I know he's capable of more than what they have him doing. So I think it's cool to see them getting an opportunity. I don't think it's going to matter. I don't think they're winning. So I think the Usos go over here. They retain the tag team titles. We have Kevin Owens defending the United States Championship against AJ Styles in what I still think could turn out to be the main event. I'm not as sure now as I was maybe a few weeks ago, but I still think this is the match on the card I'm looking forward to. Most people are probably looking forward to the most. This, to me, is the real main event for the U.S. title, and I think Kevin Owens is going to win. I think Kevin Owens gets the win here. He retains. And we have Randy Orton defending the WWE Championship against Jinder Mahal. And I am sticking to my guns that Randy Orton is winning. Jinder Mahal is not going to be WWE Champion. If Jinder Mahal does become what I believe would be the 50th man ever to hold the WWE title, I think that's a big mistake. I don't see Jinder Mahal as JBL reincarnated, where they take this guy who really wasn't doing anything and they just immediately strap the rocket on his back, launch him into the main event, and he becomes a big star and kind of grows into the role, which JBL did. But JBL had certain, qualities about him, and his verbal skills were a big part of it that I think made that work. And JBL did get over. JBL held the championship for 8 months, I think, after that. I don't see Jinder Mahal being now what JBL was in 2004, and they can try all they want to, but if you're going to try, try with Rusev. Now, Rusev, I think, may make an appearance tonight. In fact, I could see a situation where he factors into the finish of this match. Maybe he leaves Randy Orton laying when the match is over, and that could set up a match at Money in the Bank for the championship. Remember what Rusev said. He wants a championship match at Money in the Bank. Doesn't mean Shane McMahon has to give it to him. And I've seen some murmurs online that maybe Shane and Rusev may be headed for a feud. Maybe they are. Doesn't mean you can't do the championship match at Money in the Bank. Orton wins. And maybe you do something with Shane and Rusev at SummerSlam on the undercard. I think that would be fine. But I do think Randy Orton is keeping the title. I don't think that he's dropping it just yet. By the way, I mentioned before, Rusev was a no-show on SmackDown this week, even though they had promoted him or he had said he would be there. He tweeted that he was at the Predators game, the hockey game. He said, "See you when I see you." Man, I wish I could say that to my boss. He'd be like, "Hey, I know I said I'll be in the office today, but I think I'll go take in a movie instead. I'll see you when I see you." I don't think that would end very well for me. But those are your Backlash predictions for the pay-per-view tonight. I am probably going to do a review. It'll go up on the YouTube channel. But like I said, I don't feel great. My allergies have really been kicking my ass, so no guarantees. If ever there was a show I would skip out on doing a review for, it probably would be this one. So just follow me on Twitter. If I'm going to do one, I'll let everybody know. Now, I mentioned Randy Orton before. He put himself in the middle of quite the shitstorm on Twitter this week. There was a lot of sad tweeting going on this week, including Kenny King accusing Jim Cornette of being a closeted homosexual. Yes, that actually happened. But this all started when Orton retweeted something that Rip Rogers posted. Rip Rogers is a former wrestler. He's a trainer in Ohio Valley Wrestling. He helped train Randy when Randy came through OVW. Now, Rogers didn't write this. He kind of co-signed it, but he didn't actually write this. Funny enough, this was actually written by an independent wrestler. But he posted it on his Twitter, and I'll read this here because this is what kind of sparked the whole thing. "Every indie match now. Handshake, drawn out move exchange, this is awesome chant, strike exchange, dive, no sell indie strong style, dive, more strikes, no sells, dive, flippy floppy sequence, dive, hit everyone with each other's finisher, then Humpty Dumpty we all fall down, fight forever chant, rinse and repeat until every move is useless and means nothing, dive, take unsafe shot that looks like shit and hurts like hell, then roll up finish, handshake and hug after match, everyone's hand raised, all these guys chant, go home and type on social media thanking your opponents and the company for your match and telling others that they should book these guys, dive." Somebody's got to put that to music, by the way. That would make a great song. And he's not totally wrong, right? There's a lot of truth in there. I think we can all admit he's not completely wrong. Although, I have to say, Randy Orton retweeting it is very funny to me, if only because almost everyone except Orton on the WWE roster right now does at least one dive in every single one of their matches. And super kicks. Lots and lots of super kicks. So, this upset people. And Orton, while he was apparently drinking on the European tour, in response to all of the hate, he tweeted this out later on. He said, "Sorry that the indie marks, indie guys, and old-timers who do dives took offense. Just having a good time over a few drinks in Denmark, closing out the SmackDown Live tour while beating Raw in making over $5 million in the last 11 shows. Now, I know to some that doesn't equate to a standing room only crowd of 150 people paying $8 in an armory somewhere, but in the big boy world, that's called putting asses in seats. So enjoy your flips, dives, and 20 super kicks per match. To each their own, I will go dive back into my 13th title run and get ready to flip when my bank statement comes this month. Headlock. But 13 world, I forgot about that. Yeah, it is 13 world titles. This might actually be the most boring of all the 13 title runs that Randy Orton has had. Anyway, here's my take on all of this. Randy Orton has had the benefit of a very charmed career. He did not have to travel around working indies because he was Bob Orton's son. He already had an in. He had an in that most guys would love to have. And they don't have. He had two wellness strikes against him. Probably should have been a third. Then they added the Orton rule, as some people call it. He was able to work both of them, I think both of them off. At least one of them for sure, if not both strikes, he was able to work off. Again, they added this rule. You couldn't do that before then. It wasn't until Orton had the two strikes. And all of a sudden, well, let's put something in the policy that allows people to work off a strike for like good behavior if they go through rehab or some nonsense like that. Only when Orton was in jeopardy did they change the rules, okay? Guys on the indies who make a living off doing flips and dives, does it get excessive? Absolutely. I've been to plenty of indie shows. I've been to plenty of Ring of Honor shows back in the day. It is, it does get excessive. But some people like that. And these guys are trying to get noticed. They're trying to stand out. They're trying to put on a good show. They want to one day be in the cushy spot that Randy Orton finds himself in. So that they don't have to do as many flips. They don't have to do as many dives. I don't begrudge them for that. And I think Ricochet said it best, I thought. You know, he was very diplomatic in his response, which he should be if he ever wants to work for WWE. Basically, his message was, look, there's lots of fans who like lots of different things in wrestling. Everybody has different tastes. There's plenty of room for different styles. Now, you may be completely appalled, I'm sure Jim Cornette would be, by a promotion like DDT in Japan, or Kaiju Big Battle, which I see advertised every single year when I go to WrestleMania. I think they have like a midnight show for this Kaiju Big Battle, and I'm never able to go. One of these years, I will go to one of their shows, one of these years, maybe next year. I will go to one of these shows just so I can say that I got to see live monsters wrestling. Okay, but there's all this absurd stuff out there. Some people absolutely hate that stuff. They think, oh, it ruins the wrestling business in the eyes of other people, as though anyone in the mainstream, as though any quote-unquote casual wrestling fan has even heard of Kaiju Big Battle or any of this other stuff. It is such a niche thing that only the diest of diehard wrestling fans know of. And the ones that like it, they seek it out, and they enjoy it. They watch it, they buy a ticket. I don't see what the big deal is. I really don't see what the problem is. It is part of the absurdity of pro wrestling. WWE once had a creature hatch out of a giant egg and dance with Mean Gene Okerlund. Mae Young gave birth to a friggin' hand. To each their own. Now, to Orton's point, that stuff may not make $5 million like SmackDown did on their recent tour, but it's still selling tickets. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep doing these shows. It might be a smaller building. PWG, they run a building apparently that's way too small. Fits maybe, what, 400 people? But there's a huge demand for that. And PWG, you get a lot of flips and dives. You get a lot of great wrestling. You get a little bit of everything. It's a hot ticket. But I just got done, you know, for all this talk, Orton, oh, we just made $5 million on the SmackDown tour. You know, I just got done watching an episode of SmackDown last Tuesday. SmackDown, right? The show with Randy Orton as its champion. That looked like it had half the damn building tarped off. I saw some people were tweeting me photos from inside the building. It was the side that wasn't being shown on TV. Practically that entire side of the building was empty. It was embarrassing. So I would hardly say that Randy Orton has been putting as many asses in seats as he may think. Now, I'll say one last thing on this. As for this Rip Rogers character, okay, as part of all this, he ended up getting into it on Twitter with Will Ospreay, called him out, tried to get Will to do a match with him, which was so pathetic to watch. Then he made some crack about Ospreay comparing him to Jimmy Savile. And that's when I said, you know what? Okay, enough internet for the day. I guess that he was trying to be funny. Look up Jimmy Savile. There is nothing funny about that guy. Apparently, he thinks Will Ospreay has something in common with a guy who, you know, sexually abused hundreds of kids and had sex with dead bodies. But yeah, he tried to get a match with Will Ospreay out of this whole thing. He thinks he's Vader. The difference being, people actually know who Vader is. Raw Monday Night was live from Newark, New Jersey. Raw Twitter poll, over 2,000 votes. 42% thumbs up, 58% thumbs down. I thought this was a thumbs up show overall, especially after that London show the week before. Maybe I was kind of grading it on a curve a little bit, but we had some good matches. The storytelling, you know, the storytelling is still lacking. There is really nothing at all compelling on this show. I think you just kind of watch it and hope you get some good wrestling matches. There's no story on Raw right now. There's no major storyline or angle going on Raw that draws me in the least. There is not one that I could think of. But there were some good matches and some good action on here. Now, part of the problem is that they had to make some changes at the last minute. They were building around this idea of a fatal five-way at Extreme Rules to crown a new number one contender for Brock Lesnar's championship in light of the elbow injury to Braun Strowman. That threw their plans into disarray, so they made a bunch of individual matches to help build up to the fatal five-way, which has a lot of the Roman Reigns detractors overly concerned that he's going to win. I'm not sure why. I don't see that at all. I don't think he is winning. His time is coming, but it's way too early. So he ain't winning that fatal five-way. I would not worry too much about that. But speaking of Braun Strowman, we got some terrible news this week. Likely to miss up to 6 months, per WWE.com. Now, The Observer has since claimed that that timeline is exaggerated, that the original timeline, which I think Ryan Satin originally reported of 4 to 8 weeks, is more accurate, which would put him back not in time for the pay-per-view in July, but probably shortly thereafter. And that's, you know, not nearly as bad. So it's a matter of who you believe. Do you believe WWE is telling the truth? Do you believe it's part of an exaggeration so that when he comes back early, people are surprised? Probably. I'm hoping that's the case, because if he is out legitimately for 6 months, that's a disaster. So let us go by the assumption that he will be back in time for SummerSlam. But this is what they said on WWE.com. They said, following a medical consultation, Strowman underwent surgery Thursday in Birmingham. During the procedure, it was revealed, among his other injuries, that Strowman's elbow had been shattered. And see, that got me thinking. The more I think about this now, they're usually pretty specific. When they go in there and they operate and they, you know, whatever the injury is, they usually go into specific details about, oh, it's a tear or it's this or it's that. The fact that they just said his elbow was shattered and they kind of were being very vague about this, I do tend to believe they probably are just exaggerating for effect here. Let us all hope. Let us all hope. For Braun's sake, for our sake, he's been one of the few watchable things about Raw consistently week to week now, and I was genuinely looking forward to him and Brock Lesnar. It's a fresh opponent for Brock. Brock does not often get in there with somebody who's as big or bigger than he is, and also because it's the match I predicted at the beginning of the year, so I want to see my prediction come true. That's the match I'd like to see. I don't expect Braun to win the championship, but I do think that him and Brock makes for a very interesting match, provided it's not just 5 minutes of Brock suplexing him, which would be quite the disappointment. It is a match that intrigues me, and I think would be appropriate to do at SummerSlam. We had Miz and Dean Ambrose on the show for the Intercontinental Championship. They had a good match going. It was, you know, okay at first, and it kept going, and it built, and it built, and it got to a point near the end there where I was like, man, this is actually a pretty good match. And then came the finish, which they did by design, I guess, to make people want to see a rematch. Miz went for a low blow, Ric Flair style, behind the referee's back. Ambrose grabbed the arm before he could actually connect. And so he was able to prevent the low blow. Referee ended up turning around. And so what did Dean Ambrose do? Dean Ambrose goes, he hauls off, he kicks Miz right in the junk, right in front of the referee. So of course the referee called for the DQ. Boos rained down from the crowd. I don't think people were very happy with Dean Ambrose about that. Miz got the win by DQ, And then later on, we found out when Miz complained about that, that we're going to have a rematch at Extreme Rules, and it's going to be the championship can change hands on a disqualification. Ooh, what an extreme-sounding match that is. Anyway, they're going to do that match at the pay-per-view. Hopefully, they put the belt on Miz. Just, you know, enough with Ambrose Intercontinental title. I think it's run its course. I think Miz can do a lot more as the champion, and hopefully they'll make that switch at the next pay-per-view. Not a fan of the finish here, but they had a good match going there by the end. Alicia Fox pinned Sasha Banks clean with an axe kick. This was after the controversial end to their match the week before, where Sasha got the win, but it was obvious that Alicia got her shoulder up before the referee counted three. Now, I look at this and I say, wow, Sasha Banks losing clean to Alicia Fox. This makes sense only if it's building to her snapping and going heel at some point soon. I mean, I've been talking about this for a while now, and Sasha has kind of shown heel tendency. Someone posted something, and I think it was in the Facebook group. It was an old video clip of Sasha Banks from NXT doing her boss character. This was a few years ago. And it really made me think, like, you know, she really has to go back to that. The quicker that she goes heel, I think the better off she'll be. And if she is, if that's kind of where all roads lead here, then it really doesn't matter. She can lose clean to Alicia Fox. She can lose clean to almost anybody on that roster. If the plan is to just turn her or have her just break down and snap on Bayley or someone, that's fine. That's fine. So, although I will say, you know, one match I do think that is a potential money match in that women's division is Alexa Bliss against Sasha Banks. And Alexa is perfectly fine the way she is now. I would not change a thing about her persona. She is great. But if you turn Sasha, that is a little weird, right? Are you really going to put the two of them in a program if you've got two kind of bitchy heel females? Probably not. So if you do turn Sasha soon, you're kind of taking away what I think is a big match. I would get that match out of the way and then maybe, you know, worry about turning Sasha, because I do think long term that's the way to go with her. So you know what? Maybe I've been a big advocate that they should do Sasha and Bayley in Brooklyn. But I don't know. Maybe it makes more sense to shoot for Alexa and Sasha. It's a fresher match. You get it out of the way. I think it could be a fun match to build up to, and Sasha falls short, and maybe then you pull the trigger and you do the turn. And so you don't do Sasha Bayley in Brooklyn, but so what? You know, maybe that is the better way to go. But I would not get my panties in a bunch here about the fact that Sasha lost clean. I do think that there's kind of a long-term way of thinking here. I know it's not how you normally think of WWE, you know, long-term thinking that usually doesn't apply. But if that's the outcome to all this, then I don't see anything wrong with it. Alexa Bliss, speaking of which, she came out for a promo. She called Newark the sweat glands of America. Nailed Bayley with a wicked kendo stick shot to the back of the head. So Bayley had come out to confront her. They were you know, cutting a promo on each other. And I think it was Bayley who attacked Alexa. She had had enough. Alexa retrieved the kendo stick from under the ring, and let me tell you, she waffled Bayley something really, like, whacked right behind the back of the head, knocked Bayley right out of the ring. It sounded great. It sounded brutal. It was only one shot, and Alexa's like, for God's sake, she's like 4'5", but it sounded sick, and now they're going to have a kendo stick on a pole match at the Extreme Rules pay-per-view in a few weeks. Again, a weak stipulation, but that's what you do. When you have a show built around extreme-type matches, you have to come up with a bunch of stupid stipulations, and that's how you end up with a kendo stick on a pole match. We had Roman Reigns and Finn Balor. First time we've seen these two go one-on-one since Balor beat Reigns on Raw last year in what I believe was his Raw debut. And I thought this was a good match. Of course, people were very upset that Roman Reigns got the clean win. It didn't really bother me. You got to remember here, these guys, they're two of five who are involved in this Fatal 5-Way coming up in a few weeks. So you're going to get some combination of singles matches with all of them. Balor did beat him clean last year, and so that's the way things go. Roman's got to get his win back, and Roman beat him in the middle with a spear. I thought it was a good match. I don't think Balor loses anything because of it. I think people are just making too much of this. And maybe I'm just overconfident that Roman ain't winning at the pay-per-view. Like, if Roman beat Balor here just straight up, and then he goes to the pay-per-view and he beats the other four guys, okay, that's a little much to me. Like, do we really need to be doing that right now? But I don't see him winning. In fact, I think Balor has a much better shot of winning that match than Roman Reigns does. So him winning here, it didn't bother me. You know, Balor beat him, he beat Balor. Now they can have a rubber match at some point. We had Goldust turning heel on R-Truth, though Golden Truth is no longer a thing, thank God. I think that ran its course. That probably ran its course about, I don't know, 9 months ago. But yeah, no, they were backstage, and R-Truth was, I think he was apologizing to Goldust for something, and he said, tonight we're going to go out there, we're going to get back on track, we're going to beat Anderson and Gallows. They come out for the match, R-Truth is on the stick, he's doing his whole spiel, and Goldust attacks him from behind, beats him down. Nobody cared. Not a single fuck was given here. Maybe it was because it was so late in the show. I'm sure that didn't help. But for a team that's been together for a long time now, it was kind of shocking how little people really cared. In fact, I think they were chanting, "Thank you, Goldust," as he beat down R-Truth. So, that was kind of strange. I guess, you know, if I look at the two of them, if I had to pick one guy to, give a renewed singles push to or push as a heel, I was a big fan of R-Truth's initial heel turn back in, I believe, 2011, before they completely turned him into a goofy comedy character. Smoking R-Truth, remember when he turned on John Morrison? We know he's got the chops to make it work. Not that Goldust can't, but I kind of wonder if maybe they turned the wrong person. Look, in the end, it doesn't matter. They're going to battle on the pre-show on the next pay-per-view, so who gives a shit? But the crowd certainly did. The crowd certainly did not care. Seth Rollins beat Bray Wyatt in the main event by disqualification. So, breaking down the finish here, Wyatt hit a Uranage for a near fall. He went for Sister Abigail. Rollins countered. Super kick, Falcon Arrow, got another near fall. Rollins went to the top rope. Bray rolls out of the ring. Rollins dives, he hits a plancha on Wyatt out on the floor. All of a sudden, out of the crowd comes Samoa Joe. He cannot let this go. Samoa Joe, he jumps on Rollins for the DQ. So now you have, back in the ring, you've got Wyatt and Joe working together to beat down Seth Rollins. Wyatt is now trying to hold Joe back. It's like these two heels working together. All of a sudden, Wyatt gives Joe Sister Abigail, lays him out. Got some cheers for that from the crowd. And then Wyatt hit Rollins with Sister Abigail, and they went off the air with Bray Wyatt as the last man standing, or kneeling, as it were. So they're trying to, you know, make some people stand out here heading into this Fatal 5-Way. It is Balor, Rollins, Wyatt, Reigns, and who's the other guy? Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, Bray Wyatt, Finn Balor. Who is the fifth guy in that match? It's not the Intercontinental Champion, so it's not Ambrose. Who the hell is the fifth guy? I don't even know. There's five guys in this match, though. Take my word for it. There are five guys in this match. I don't remember who the fifth guy is all of a sudden. Seth Rollins, Finn Balor, Roman Reigns, Samoa Joe. Idiot. This is how little I pay attention to Raw now. This is how bad it's gotten, I have to tell you. Now, Samoa Joe was in that match as well. In fact, yes, they showed graphics at the beginning of the show. They were putting graphics up on the screen of Brock Lesnar facing each one of those five guys. And when I saw the graphic on the screen of Joe and Lesnar, I got kind of excited. I said, hey, you know what? That's a match I'd like to see. None of the other ones really appealed to me. Balor maybe, because I think that would be an interesting match, given, you know, Balor's a smaller guy, Brock is a bigger guy. That is a match I'd kind of be interested in seeing, more so than, you know, Brock and Wyatt. Brock and Rollins, I'm sure they'd have a good match. But Brock and Joe, I think, could be a real, real fun match at some point if they decide to go that way. I don't see that happening. So SmackDown, I already talked about. I incorporated that into the Backlash predictions. As far as NXT, I mean, I'm not even going to play the music here. Again, I really don't feel good this week. I'm trying to steamroll right along here. And there's a lot to get to. You know, NXT, last Wednesday, there really isn't much to say about the TV show from last week. We had two guys in the main event who weren't even on the TakeOver card last night. We had Cassius Ohno beating Andrade Cien Almas. I thought they had a real good match. And there really is absolutely nothing else to say about that show from last week. It really wasn't that good. We got a lot of video packages, a lot of stuff that really didn't tie into TakeOver. I am going to talk about TakeOver last night in a second. First, there's some news from this week's Wrestling Observer I have to get to on probably the two best female wrestlers in the world right now on their way to NXT. The news dropped this week that Io Shirai of the Stardom promotion in Japan has in fact accepted an offer from WWE. She had attended a tryout camp a few months ago. There was some talk that, you know, was she going to want to come to WWE? She might not be all that enamored about coming over. Not that it didn't go well, but maybe she was having second thoughts. Well, apparently that's in the past. It's all moot point now because she's on her way in, along with Kairi Hojo, also from the Stardom promotion. So Stardom really getting the short end of the stick here. Two of their biggest attractions are leaving at the same time. It's kind of like when New Japan got hit last year by the news that Nakamura was leaving, AJ was leaving, Gallows was leaving, and Anderson was leaving. And AJ, Gallows, and Anderson all gave the news to New Japan in the same night that they were on their way out. Now, New Japan is big enough, and they have enough talent where they can absorb those types of losses. You know, Tanahashi just went down with a bicep injury. Apparently, he's going to keep wrestling, which is really stupid. But if he goes down, let's say for 6 months, if he breaks down and says, okay, I'll have surgery, yeah, that's a big blow to New Japan. Plus, you've got Shibata, who may never wrestle again. But New Japan has enough talent where they can sustain that. I'm not as familiar with the Stardom promotion, but I look at this and I say, is that something they could survive? I mean, this is two of their biggest stars leaving at the same time. I'm not sure they have anybody else who can really pick up the slack. So for them, it sucks. But their loss is NXT's gain. Now, also, this was also in the Observer this week, and this made me shake my head so hard, I gave myself whiplash. Kairi Hojo, who I've talked about on this show before, I told everybody who may not be familiar with her, as I wasn't, go on YouTube, check out some of her matches, check out her flying elbow smash, the best elbow drop in all of wrestling. She decided to leave Stardom, right, to come to WWE, so she's on her way in. Well, apparently she's been told to find a new finishing maneuver. The elbow drop is out. Why? Because that's Bayley's finisher. That's what she was told. Bayley uses a flying elbow as her finish. You can't. You've got to find a new move. I guess they don't want two women sharing the same finish, because God knows there's plenty of moves that multiple guys in WWE use. Right? The frog splash, the falcon arrow. I guess this is a different situation. They don't want her using the same move. And I'm looking at this and I'm just saying to myself, you sign the woman with the best elbow drop in the business and immediately tell her to find a new move. It is infuriating. Now, it may save her from a hip replacement down the road. I mean, seriously, I watch her, like, deliver the elbow. It's so much fun to watch her do it, but she lands right on her hip. Like, it's kind of painful to watch. Now, if it's a safety thing, if you've ever seen her do it, like I said, the way she lands on her hip, I could at least understand that. If the news was they're a little concerned about her long-term health, she's going to be wrestling more often on the road here than she was in Japan, and to do that every single night, night after night, the wear and tear, it's just not going to be good. They have to protect their investment. Like, if that's the rationale behind this, even though I'm still, like, you know, bummed out about it, I can understand that. Like, that I can understand. Out of an abundance of caution, let's find you another move. And you could still use the elbow every now and then, but we got to find you something else that you can use more consistently. You can save the elbow for big matches. Okay, fine, that makes sense. Look at Fandango. Fandango used to do the diving leg drop, which looked painful as all hell. He would land on his tailbone. If they said don't use the elbow all the time, perfectly sensible. But that doesn't sound like what's going on here, and to me that's just incredibly stupid. That's one of her strengths. That's one of the things that probably got her noticed in the first place by WWE. And to turn around and say, you can't do it. And I'm thinking about Bayley, and I'm like, I've seen Bayley use the elbow as a finish maybe twice, including WrestleMania, when she beat Charlotte with it. I've maybe seen her win one more match on TV with that move. she still, by and large, uses the belly to Bailey. Is it really that big of a deal? I don't know. I don't know the way they think sometimes. Real quick, the UK Championship Series that aired on Friday, I did watch that. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I enjoyed the chemistry between Jim Ross and Nigel McGuinness. Having listened to Nigel on that show and having listened to Nigel at TakeOver last night, Nigel's really good. And I think he's really kind of finding his voice. Not to say that he was terrible when he first started, but maybe, I don't know if timid is the right word for it. I felt the same way about Regal. William Regal is always very low, right? He's a very low talker, very soft talker. As Regal was doing commentary more and more before they made him the GM for NXT, I felt like he was kind of finding his voice and really growing into the role. And I kind of feel the same way about Nigel. And I just, you know, having listened to his work over the last 48 hours, I just thought it was worth mentioning. I thought he did a really good job. In fact, I thought in the match last night at TakeOver, they brought him and Jim Ross in to call the UK title match. And it, I mean, not that JR did a bad job or anything like that, but that was all Nigel. And it makes sense, right? Because Nigel is going to be more familiar with those guys and that style, coming from that background than Jim Ross would be. But I thought he carried the whole thing, and I thought together they worked very well. As far as the show itself, I got to see my boy Wolfgang. That's always cool. I became a big Wolfgang fan after the UK Championship Tournament. He got a win over Joseph Connors. Pete Dunne, great match against Trent Seven. I love the fact that he came out to the ring with the Progress title. They even acknowledged that on the air, that it was the Progress title. But they had an excellent match. And then Tyler Bate and Mark Andrews in the main event for the UK Championship. Tyler Bate getting the win over Mark Andrews. Again, another fantastic match. I love the setting. It was a small venue in Norwich. I just love the presentation and everything about it. And I am looking forward to seeing a weekly UK series, what form that takes on the network. We know it's coming. We don't know when. This was a one-shot special. But as they record more of these in the future, I will definitely watch them. I will definitely check them out. Now, TakeOver was last night from Chicago, from the Allstate Arena. An excellent show. It had a good opener. An out-of-this-world match that'll be in the running for Match of the Year for sure. And a memorable heel turn at the very end of the show. We have not seen a heel turn like this, as many of you pointed out on Twitter. We have not seen a turn like this since Rollins killed the Shield. So if you are an NXT fan, if you have followed DIY for any length of time, this was a big deal, what happened last night. I like how they positioned it at the very end of the show for added effect. It was also a very heel-heavy show as far as champions are concerned. In fact, the heels won in every single title match on this show. Unless you still think Asuka is a babyface, even though she's not. Poll results, over 1,600 now going on 1,700 votes so far. You can still vote. 92% thumbs up, only 8% thumbs down. And I could tell you at least three of those I know were mistakes. One guy said he was drunk and he accidentally hit the thumbs down when he meant thumbs up. So just consider that. I'm not even sure how you can find 8% of people who would give this show a thumbs down reasonably, but again, everyone has their opinion. No Adam Cole. I thought for sure we'd at least get an appearance in the crowd or something. No new faces at all in the audience this time. No Adam Cole, or, you know, Kyle O'Reilly is another name that's been rumored to pop up soon. Mike Bennett, right? Mike Bennett and Maria, who supposedly are going straight to SmackDown, but wouldn't shock me if they popped up first in NXT. The only ones they showed in the crowd were Kevin Owens, who's hardly a new face. Sami Zayn, who was sitting with Pat Patterson and Chris Hero only a few rows away. And I joked, I said, like, is there some kind of a law that requires Sami Zayn to always be within 50 feet of Kevin Owens? A lot of you called it the reverse restraining order. I think that's what it is. I think there's some sort of a reverse or like bizarro form of a restraining order that requires the two of them to always be in close proximity to each other. It's like they are incapable of leaving each other's side. It's amazing. They showed Owens and then they cut to Sami. I'm like, my God, you know? And in kayfabe, what must Kevin Owens be thinking? He can't get rid of this guy. He goes to SmackDown, then Sami comes to SmackDown. He goes to TakeOver, then Sami comes to TakeOver. I could like picture like Kevin Owens is trying to take a dump. Like he's sitting in the stall reading the newspaper, reading like a zoology magazine or something. And then he looks down and he sees like this boot coming underneath the stall, like from the stall next to him. And it's like Sami Zayn, who's like right beside him. It's like this guy can't get rid of Sami Zayn. So, we have Roderick Strong and Eric Young as the opener here on this show. This was a match that was added at the last minute. Not the last minute, but a few days before. And probably the match I had the least amount of interest and excitement over. And it turned into a damn good match, I have to say. Not the biggest Eric Young fan in the world. I've never been. Roderick Strong, we all know, great wrestler. Kind of vanilla for a long time. These video packages did him a world of good over the last few weeks. Even coming out, he got this huge reaction coming out in Chicago. And they were able to put together a damn good match. Roddy got the win in the end. And I don't know if this is going to continue or if he's finally going to move on to someone else. But it's clear that between the video packages and giving him a win here on this show, they're getting behind Roddy. There is bigger things in his future. And, I got an email from somebody, it's not part of the mailbag later, but I'll bring it up now. He was asking me, do I think now would be a good time to add a secondary championship to NXT? Because you have guys like Roderick Strong, and you have Cassius Ohno, and there's a lot of people coming in soon, too. I am convinced that we're going to see guys like Kyle O'Reilly and Adam Cole soon enough coming to NXT. You've got Andrade Cien Almas, you've got Drew Galloway, you've got Aleister Black. Now you've got the Velveteen Dream, Patrick Clark, right? He's on his way in. It seems to me like now would be a good time, and I've thought this for a while, but now especially would be a good time to add a secondary championship of some kind to NXT. I agree. I think this would be a good time for that, and I think somebody like Roderick Strong would benefit greatly from holding on to, or even if he's not holding it, just to have something to chase after, I think would make a lot of sense. We had Tyler Bate and Pete Dunne for the UK Championship. This was the match I was looking forward to the most. And to say that it delivered would be quite the understatement. I think that would be understating it to an enormous degree. They had the best match of the night. They had what I have no doubt will go down as the best match of the weekend. And I'm saying this hours before Backlash. There is absolutely nothing. There isn't a single match on the Backlash card. And that includes Kevin Owens and AJ Styles. And I love them to death. But there is not a single match on that Backlash card tonight that will even touch the match that these two guys had. They had a match of the year contender, whatever your criteria is for match of the year. They tore the house down. Great wrestling, great psychology, great crowd engagement and reaction. People hanging on to every near fall. It had everything that you would look for in a wrestling match, as far as I can tell. It had the emotion, it had the action. And in the end, Pete Dunne got the win. Pete Dunne, as I predicted and had hoped, wins the UK Championship, which is going to make things very interesting now if he starts to show up more in NXT, now that he's the champ. We all know the relationship between him and William Regal. It may never lead to a match, but I just love that look of disdain that Regal has on his face for this guy every time they cross paths. So it'll be very interesting now to see what, if any, kind of interaction him and Pete Dunne have on TV. But I can't say enough good things about this match. And not only everything I just mentioned about the crowd reaction and the action itself and the psychology, and the way that Pete Dunne breaks down the different body parts and he just, bends the fingers and the joints and everything else. But you had the benefit of having Jim Ross, the greatest announcer of all time, and Nigel McGuinness calling the action. And I thought they did a bang up job, which is not to say that Tom Phillips is bad. I think Tom Phillips is good. And I think Nigel, we all know, I was just talking, Nigel is very good. Percy Watson, nice guy. That's about the only thing I could say about him. He's a complete waste of space out there, but they want three people, so whatever, it is what it is. I don't think he contributes anything to these shows. But you had JR and Nigel calling this match, and I can't think of a better match on that card for the two of them to call. I mean, it's that perfect style. Which I'm sure is why they put the two of them together on those UK shows. So if you missed this match, you really did yourself a disservice. You got to go back, and if nothing else, you've got to watch this match. Watch it twice. That's how good it was. And Pete Dunne's going places. I know he does. He's not a big guy, but Pete Dunne is a heel. Like if I were to paint a picture of what a heel would look like, how a heel would act, how a heel would behave, the snarl, the style, it would be Pete Dunne. The Miz is probably the best example I could think of on the main roster of somebody in WWE right now as far as best heels. And what I mean by that is not just the way they act, but the way the people react to them. you don't see anybody coming out, right, when Miz is out there going, you know, yay for the Miz. Like, the Miz doesn't get very many cheers from people. People genuinely find him annoying, dislike him, want him to get his ass kicked, think he has a very punchable face, all that kind of stuff. Pete Dunne was getting a lot of cheers last night, but I do look at him and I think to myself, this is what a heel should be. Like, if he were to go to the main roster right now, I don't know what they would do with him. They'd probably just stick him on 205 Live or something, and that would be the death of him, but he's better than that. I mean, he could be, I think, a real player on that main roster at some point in the not-too-distant future. I wouldn't, you know, bring him up right now. I think he's got a good thing going down in NXT and with the UK stuff. But looking forward, I would say Pete Dunne could be very valuable to a Raw or a SmackDown as one of the top heels on that brand. Absolutely. We had a lot, I mean, so many spots in this match for me to even recap. The X-Plex on the apron made me go, holy shit, I could tell you that, when he flipped him in the air and he landed right on his hip on the apron, which, in case you didn't know, is the hardest part of the ring. I know they told you that every 5 seconds, but it's true. That is, in fact, the hardest part of the ring. There was another, what was the other spot in this match that I almost jumped out of my seat? Bate went to the top rope. And he came off with, it was either a shooting star press or a Phoenix splash, which is impressive enough. But on the way down, Dunne caught him in some kind of a, it was either an arm bar or I think a triangle choke. Like, it was so seamless. It was so smooth. That was very cool. You could tell these guys have worked together a time or two in the past. And I would love to see more matches between them. You know, Tyler Bate, you would think, is going to be owed a rematch, so we're going to at least get one more. I wouldn't mind these two taking it all the way to Brooklyn in August, and if you want to build to a 2 out of 3 falls match or some kind of stipulation, not like a crazy stip, but something like that. You know, 2 out of 3 falls is the kind of stip I think that would work for these guys. You know, I wouldn't be doing a kendo stick on a pole like they're doing in Extreme Rules with Bayley and Alexa. The airplane spin, that was the other thing I wanted to mention. So Tyler Bate does an airplane spin in his matches. It's very old school. You look at it, you go, it's kind of a goofy move, right? It's kind of like the Cesaro swing. What does it really do? Well, it disorients you. I have not seen anybody ever that I could think of in all the years I've seen. I've gone back and I've watched old wrestling and I've seen guys do airplane spins. Roddy Piper would do the airplane spin a lot. I've never seen somebody do an airplane spin with such velocity. Like, he was spinning him so hard, he got the crowd to give him a standing ovation for a friggin' airplane spin. This guy got a standing ovation. I've never seen that before. And then, of course, he puts him down, and Bate looks like he's had about, I don't know, 17 vodka sodas or something, and he, you know, falls down on top of Dunne, gets a near fall out of it. But people, I mean, the way they reacted to an airplane spin, and then the near fall, as though he was going to win with it. Like, these guys had the crowd in the palm of their hands. It was so much fun to watch. Of course, Dunne got the win in the end with the bitter end, which is his finish. And he is now the United Kingdom champion. And we'll see what happens. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch. You know, Pete Dunne against Tyler Bate. Pete Dunne against maybe Wolfgang at some point and some of the other talent that they bring in. You know, Pete Dunne and Drew Galloway maybe on NXT at some point down the road. See, that would be interesting if only because Galloway is a big guy. Like, he's really tall. I don't know. He's probably every bit of 6'5", maybe. And Dunne is not. So, looking, you know, if you were to look at them side by side, I wonder if it would look like a mismatch. I feel like as a match, it would be friggin' fantastic. But I'm talking more like the visual of it, what that might look like. But we'll see. But Pete Dunne, it has to be mentioned, with not one, but 2 Match of the Year caliber matches airing within the span of 24 hours. I mean, they taped the UK special and the match with Trent 7 weeks ago, but it aired on Friday, and then on Saturday, he had what could very well be the Match of the Year with Tyler Bate. It's pretty impressive. That right there should tell you something about this guy. We had Asuka, Ruby Riott, and Nikki Cross triple threat match for the NXT Women's Championship. Poor Ember Moon was relegated to watching from the ceiling. Where the hell was she? She was all the way up in the rafters. And I loved it too because they had a shot of her watching the match at one point. So she's not watching on a monitor. She's all the way up. She's looking down. She's watching the action. But still, she's got her body turned. in such a way, like, nobody would be standing watching the show like this, but there she is, doing the old WWE pose. She's officially been indoctrinated into the way things work here in this company now. I thought that this match was a good match. It was not a great match, and it had a very weird kind of flat finish. I was not a fan of the finish. Ruby had knocked Nikki down. She had Nikki beat. Asuka was about a second or two off. She was trying to break up the fall. Referee kind of had to hold up the count a little bit. Asuka hit Ruby with a kind of a sliding drop kick to the face. And Asuka falls on top of both of them and basically pins them both. And retains her championship and gets the win. Now, not a shock that she would retain the title. I thought there was practically zero chance of Asuka's long-running streak coming to an end in some, you know, three-way that wasn't even supposed to be a three-way. But, you know, they made the most of it. Again, there was some good action here, but I just thought that I've seen better from the women, and I thought the finish brought it down a notch. So I wasn't as impressed as some other people were. We have Bobby Roode and Hideo Itami for the NXT Championship. Second to last match on the show. Very interesting positioning here. Obviously, they wanted to save the big heel turn for the very end. So, between Hideo Itami coming out for a big championship match that isn't even in the main event, and then losing as he did, effectively fair and square, to Bobby Roode here in this first match, I look at this, and I just watched him like walking out there. And I don't think it bodes well for where he ends up on the main roster, if he eventually makes it to the main roster. I'm really starting to doubt his future in this company. Not that he'll leave, but that if he stays and he does eventually get promoted, what are they really going to do with him? Are they going to push him in either a main event role, an upper mid-card role? Is he going to be positioned on the main roster the way he's been positioned here in NXT? And I think the answer to that is no. I really do think there's more chance that he'll end up in the cruiserweight division, and maybe for him that's not a bad thing. I think maybe that is the best place for him to be when he initially comes up. If he happens to catch fire with the crowd and people really get into him and take to him, then you could always promote him outside of the cruiserweight division. But he's an example of somebody who I think that would be probably the best place for him. To me, there's no way that they see him as a top guy. You know, once he hits Raw or SmackDown, I don't see it. I think he'll be relegated to the Cruiserweights. I think that's where he's destined to end up. But the finish was, he hit the GTS on Bobby Roode. Seemed to get boos for it, given they were in Chicago. But he hit the GTS. Bobby Roode rolls out to the floor. That effectively saved his championship. So Itami goes outside. He brings him back into the ring. Goes for a second GTS, but Bobby Roode blocked it on the way down. He turned it into the glorious DDT, and he kind of rolled through, hit another DDT, which actually looked kind of brutal, and he got the pin. So I thought the two of them had a pretty good match, and I actually loved the finish, the opposite of the women's match, where I thought the finish was flat and kind of weird. I actually really liked the finish here to this match, and I think it certainly solidified Bobby Roode as the champ. He got a clean win over over his challenger. Maybe it didn't do any favors for Hideo Itami, but it keeps Bobby Roode going until at least Brooklyn, I would think. I don't see them taking the title off him before then, and even then it depends on who they put him up against. I look at the lay of the land here, and I could see Bobby Roode defending the championship against Drew McIntyre as the main event for that TakeOver show. But don't forget about Aleister Black. I mean, he's still new. We haven't really seen him in a competitive match yet, aside from the one he lost in the UK tournament back in January. I guess we'll forget that happened. They were calling him Tommy End, right? They called him Tommy End on that show. So I guess technically he wasn't Aleister Black yet, so maybe it doesn't count. Anyway, so Bobby Roode is still the champion. And Hideo Itami has a very murky future. I don't know if they come back and they do a rematch. To me, why do you bother? The champion in the first match, the champion beat the guy clean. Why would Hideo Itami get a rematch? You know, and if they do it, it'll obviously just be on TV 1 week. But I don't even know that there's a need or a reason for Itami to get a rematch. He got beat, you know, fair and square. He got beat right in the middle. Main event was the Authors of Pain defending the NXT Tag Team Championships against DIY in a ladder match, the first ever tag team ladder match in NXT. Now, Ciampa, there was some question about him going into this because he got hurt at a live event in Kentucky on Thursday night. Early in the match, I think he did kind of a running knee dive off the apron, landed awkwardly, apparently sprained his ankle. It turned out to not be a break or a fracture or a torn ligament or something like that. He really dodged a bullet. They did cut that match short. They sent a replacement match out there. Look, it's wrestling, right? So never say never. Looking back on it now, could that have been a work? Yeah, it could have, but that never really factored into the match. Like, if the ankle factored into this match in some way, then I would say, oh, well, this is too convenient. Maybe this was all part of the plan. This was all part of the story. But I take it that was not the case. And thankfully for him, it was just a sprain. I saw him wrapping it up before the show. But there was some question about whether or not they'd be able to even do the match. Can you imagine what a disaster that would have been if they did, looking back now, what they ended up doing and how they ended the show, if they had to scrap that match because of the injury? That would have been really, really shitty. So they have this ladder match. You wonder, how are the Authors of Pain going to be here? We've not seen these guys in a ladder match before. I've seen them in there with teams and have a good match. I've seen them in there and have some not-so-good matches. This was one of, if not the best Authors of Pain match that I've seen. And I think DIY does deserve a lot of credit for that. You know, I mean, these guys are not really all that experienced. But they held their own, and I thought both teams did a hell of a job. I thought it was a really, really good match. DIY had the belts won. Paul Ellering runs into the ring. He stops Johnny Gargano at one point from climbing and bringing down the championship. And Gargano gives him a super kick. First bump that we've seen Paul Ellering take since he returned to WWE. And he's, you know, he's an older man. I was kind of surprised, to be honest with you. But he ate a super kick. And we had Akam and Rezar going for a ladder shot. They had the ladder. They were going to whack Ciampa with the ladder right in the head, right in the face. Johnny Gargano, the best friend that he is, the good friend, loyal friend that he is, he basically takes a bullet for this man. The bullet came in the form of a ladder, but he shoves Ciampa out of the way. He eats a ladder shot to the face that I thought killed him. I thought he was dead. Dead. Brutal shot to the face. And if anything, if I had one criticism of this, it was so brutal. Okay, if we're supposed to believe that you take a ladder, a giant ladder like that, and whack somebody in the face with it. You know, look, it's wrestling, right? You always have to suspend your disbelief. No black and blue, no stitches, no blood. All that is true. But a shot like that, Gargano should have been out for the rest of the show. He never should have even gotten back up. That's how wicked that looked. So after that, Ciampa was pretty much on his own. He tried. He had a very impressive spot where he was able to German suplex one of the big guys off the ladder. He crashed through another ladder that was kind of propped up in the corner, and you could see the wood. Like, that ladder snapped right in half. I'm like, oh, that's a wooden ladder. That's interesting. The camera was right there. I mean, you could tell what the friggin' thing was made of. But it was an impressive spot, right? It looked cool. And he tried. He really did. He tried as much as he could. Gargano did make his way back up. Again, somehow he was able to remain conscious and, you know, got back into the match. They even hit their stereo finish on one of the Authors of Pain, who had the ladder placed over his neck. And you really thought that this was going to be it. You know, this was going to be the big win here for DIY getting their belts back. But while they're on the ladder reaching up for the championships, the Authors of Pain grab them off, powerbomb them. They give them the Super Collider where they powerbomb them into each other, and then they powerbomb them down to the mat. And that was it. That spelled the end for DIY. Authors of Pain climb up. They retrieve the titles. They are still the NXT Tag Team Champions. Crowd was not happy about that. And I'm thinking to myself, man, what a, not lame, but like, what a disappointing way for the show to end. It's like, you just, it was weird enough seeing this match in the main event spot, and they had a great match, but then the heels just went and won. So now I'm thinking, okay, maybe something's going on here, right? Because how many months have I been talking about Ciampa's going to turn on Gargano? It's going to happen here, or it should happen there. And it never happened. And as time has gone on, I see these two and I'm like, you know what? I'm kind of glad it never happened, because when these guys ultimately get called up to the main roster, they're going to be able to have some wars again with the Revival, and I could watch those guys wrestle all day long. They're going to have, maybe they'll have matches with the, American Alpha. Maybe we'll get to see DIY against the Hardy Boys, right? That could be a lot of fun. So I became, more fan of keeping them together as opposed to splitting them up. But now all of a sudden I'm watching this and I'm like, uh-oh, I don't like where this is going. So they got up and the Chicago crowd is giving them a standing ovation. And I love the way they milked this, because you thought, like, as they're standing in the ring, you're just waiting for Ciampa to drop the bomb. And then they didn't. And as they're leaving the ring, I'm like, well, maybe he'll do what Kevin Owens did. Kevin Owens attacks Sami Zayn right there in the aisle. But then they cut to another replay. So finally they come back and they put the copyright notice on the screen. Like, they're going off the air. They've got you convinced that this is where the show is going to end. And sure enough, Tommaso Ciampa grabs Johnny Gargano and he throws him into the stage, right into the wall, gives him a knee to the head. People are chanting Psycho Killer. They're booing. He throws Gargano up on the announce table, which was positioned by the aisleway the way they have it on Monday Night Raw. He goes to pick him up to give him like a, basically he gave him white noise, or the old Emerald Frozen that Finlay used to do, off of the announce table, down through a bunch of tables that had been set up down below, just completely laid out his partner, now ex-partner. And Ciampa is now sitting on the announce desk looking down at all the destruction that he has wrought upon this man, all the officials coming out to tend to Johnny Gargano. And Ciampa, like a psycho killer, I guess, fits the nickname, is just sitting there. He is sitting there kind of admiring his work. It's hard to tell what kind of emotion he was trying to show, whether it was remorse, but I guess that story will unfold in the weeks ahead. But DIY is no more. And, my first thought, my first thought was it was something to see the total apathy to the Goldust heel turn with R-Truth on Raw last Monday, and then to see how big the people reacted to this turn. And granted, Goldust and R-Truth, they're an undercard comedy act. They're not really focused on, but they've been together for a long time, right? They've been a team probably in WWE now longer than DIY has been. And, Goldust has been around forever. R-Truth has been around forever. It's not like people don't know who they are. It's not like they're not familiar with them. And I said in the Raw review, people did not give two shits about Goldust turning on R-Truth. And they were completely apathetic to the whole thing. And this was the polar opposite. This just goes to show, when you really build things up in a good way, you've got these two guys going out there every takeover show. They're tearing the house down. They're stealing the show. You tell this story about how they've got to get their belts back. They were the champs. Then they had the titles ripped away from them. And this is their chance to redeem themselves and get their belts back. And they fall just short of that goal. And when you tell that story and all the pieces fall into place, the people will reward you for it. If you tell a good story and you can get people invested, you get people to care about these guys, then in the end, it will pay off. And I think they got exactly the reaction that they were hoping for. They were cutting to the crowd, people putting their hands over their mouths and gasping, oh my God, I can't believe this. It was just amazing to see the reaction to this as compared. And we just saw something similar 5 days earlier. You got two heel turns in 1 week, and boy, It's like the tale of two cities between these two heel turns. So that was the first thing I thought of. I love the hell out of it. I thought they did a tremendous job with it. I thought it was a fantastic heel turn, but I am bummed that they broke them up before we got to see them work their magic on the main roster. Now, a lot of you were responding back to me when I said that on Twitter and said, yes, but Solo Monster, look at what they've done to American Alpha and other teams that have come up to the main roster. And you make a great point. So it kind of goes both ways. On the one hand, I think you can be disappointed that we're not going to get to see DIY. And again, who's to say that you can't put them back together at some point? That's true. But certainly initially, we're not going to get them up as a tag team. And it would have been great to see them go in there and have, classic matches against, the Revival, or against American Alpha, or against the Hardys, all those teams I just mentioned. And now we're not going to get that. And I also think to myself, well, they're going to go into the Barclays Center in August and probably tear the house down there in a singles match. Remember the match they had in the Cruiserweight Classic? They wrestled in the opening round. They had one of the best matches in the entire tournament. Now, we're actually going to have a story behind it. We're not just going to have two best friends, two baby faces, just put in a match. Like, they can really build this up as a personal issue between these two, to the point where Johnny Gargano just wants to get his hands on this guy. Maybe it's going to be hard, I think, to keep them apart for that long. I certainly would not want them to give the match away on TV. I would hope they're going to build to the match. But August is still a long ways off, so it's going to be hard. I don't know that they can wait that long. Maybe they do the match. Maybe there's some other takeover. Is there a takeover between now and August? I don't even know. There could be another one, maybe, in end of June, early July. I'm honestly not sure. So maybe they do the first match there, and then they build to a second match in Brooklyn. But to me, if that Brooklyn show is becoming one of the bigger takeover shows of the year, this is a match that you can, if not headline with, you can certainly co-headline with. You can have the NXT title on top. You can have this match underneath. You can have a UK title match on that show. And Ember Moon, back from her injury, she could go after Asuka for the championship. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can go with that card in August if that's kind of what they're building to. But you look at the plus side, we're going to get a hot feud now between these two in NXT. If they play their cards right, I think the potential here is great. And Ciampa probably is better off as a heel, in all honesty. They don't call this guy Psycho Killer for nothing. Johnny Gargano is a fantastic babyface. These two guys were singles wrestlers before they put them together. They put them together as a makeshift tag team. It's not like they came into the company as a team. They got put together. But they're so friggin' good, they turned it into this hot act. Now that they've split them up, I think it's easy to forget that they're really singles wrestlers, right? That's where they thrive. That's what they were before DIY became a thing. And so now we get to see what they can do, you know, one-on-one. And that's also pretty exciting. Someone also tweeted at me and they said, you know, well, maybe Vince could bring him up to the main roster and put them on 205 Live, and they can feud over the Cruiserweight title. And I said, do you hate these two men? Because that's about the only reason I could think of why you would make that kind of suggestion. 205 Live would be a death sentence for these two. No offense to Neville, no offense to Aries or Gallagher. They have a lot of talented guys on that show. They're all very, very talented. But 205 Live and that whole division is hardly lighting the world on fire right now, the way it's being presented. And so if given the choice, if you said, okay, you want them on the main roster, that's where they're going to end up and they can feud there. Or do you keep them in NXT and have them feud there? To me, the choice is easy. I would keep them down there as long as possible and let them feud in NXT. And I think in Full Sail, I think it'll work a lot better that way. God forbid. Can you imagine that if in the next like month or so, somehow they both ended up on the main roster, but they were just kind of shoehorned into that Cruiserweight division. This thing would die a death. But in NXT, I'm actually pretty excited to see what they can do one-on-one. The problem now is you look at the tag team scene in NXT. You've got the Authors of Pain. You've got Heavy Machinery, who I've become a big fan of. You've got you got Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli. What are the other teams? I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two, but I can't think of any other tag teams right now in NXT. So that's the problem by breaking up DIY, is now all of a sudden you're left with a whole lot of nothing. My guess would be we'll start to see some new teams pop up, and now you've got to establish those new teams. That takes time. Who takes the belts off AOP? I don't see anyone. I don't think Heavy Machinery are going to get them anytime soon. Could be a good spot for Red Dragon to come in. You know, Kyle O'Reilly's been rumored for a while, but, you know, Bobby Fish, who's to say that Bobby Fish doesn't eventually make his way to NXT? And I think if you can get both of those guys, you got to bring them in as a team. And so, effectively, you could potentially have Red Dragon coming to NXT to take the place of DIY. But even if that were to happen, you still have an issue. You still have a void to fill, I think, in that tag team division, because I don't see anybody on the horizon who they can match AOP up with, where you would think, okay, they're going to pull the trigger and do a title change. Well, who that team would be, I have no idea. That's why I thought of Red Dragon. If they make their way over, that would be a big addition to that division. And now it is about that time of week where we say something nice about Impact.
Say something nice about Impact.
Not only do I have one nice thing to say about Impact, I have two. First, we had the return of an old favorite of mine on Thursday, one of my favorite characters from back during that period where I was watching Impact every week, Joseph Park Esquire. Yes, Joe Park is back. Jeremy Borash revealed him to be the new attorney, representing him, helping him to get reinstated back to television as Impact's play-by-play announcer. Josh Matthews pitched a fit, and I came this close to turning off the show because this guy has go-away heat with me. He is so awful. And the entire storyline is, of course, completely ludicrous. But we got Joe Park back, and Josh Matthews left the show at that point, which meant that JB took over for the main event, which is the other nice thing I have to say this week about Impact. What a great main event! It was the best match on any wrestling show on TV all week, until, and that's the caveat here, until I saw the two Pete Dunne matches on Friday and Saturday, and the Tyler Bate Mark Andrews match on Friday. Ultimate X now sits at number 4. It has been demoted to number 4 for the week, which is still not a bad place to be. I mean, there's a lot of wrestling matches on TV this week, right? Between Raw, SmackDown, NXT, Impact, the UK show, NXT TakeOver, and I'll even throw Backlash in there tonight. And Ultimate X, again, I would put that in the top 5, certainly, of great matches for the week. It was a 3-way Ultimate X match for the X Division Championship. It was low-key defending against Trevor Lee and Andrew Everett, the same Andrew Everett who apparently worked this match, which included climbing and falling from great heights, worked it with a torn meniscus in his knee. He's been working hurt for 7 months, and finally he has decided to have the injury operated on. But you'd never know he was hurt watching this. I really enjoyed this match. I love the whole low-key hitman look. I think that it works for him. I know he did that at a New Japan show. It might have been one of the Wrestle Kingdom shows a number of years ago. But I still think it's a cool look. I watched low-key, and I don't know how old he is now. He's been around for a while. I watch him, and I just shake my head when I think back to the way WWE used him when they had him under contract. They put him with Lay Cool. Like, that was their grand idea for this guy. I don't know if they felt like he's got no personality or he's got no sense of humor. We've got to lighten him up a little bit. I don't know what the rationale was behind it. It was classic, typical WWE bullshit. They put him with friggin' Michelle McCool and Layla. That was their great idea for him. You know, but then again, this is also the same company that gave Ricochet a tryout and passed on him. So I don't know why I'm so surprised by this. There was actually some psychology that played into the finish here of this match. Believe it or not, it was not. You don't see a lot of that in these car crash type matches. But low-key had punched a steel chair back into Trevor Lee's face a little bit earlier in the match. So when he went to climb the structure, if you know the rules of how an Ultimate X match works, he was still favoring the hand. So he climbed up, but he couldn't grip the cable to kind of shimmy himself across and retrieve the belt. So instead, he climbed all the way up to the top of the structure. Meanwhile, Lee and Everett, they climbed up. They're working their way across the cable. All you have to do is work your way to the middle, grab that belt, and unhook it, and you're the champion. Low Key's on top of the structure above them. He sees what's going on here. He worms his way down through some of the scaffolding. Now he's basically standing over them. He stomps their hands, he stomps their face, both men fall to the mat, they take big bumps all the way from the top of the structure down to the mat, and low-key grabs the title for the win. So he retains the X Division Championship. These guys worked their asses off here in this match. I was entertained, and that's really, in the end, all that matters. So, thumbs up.
Say something nice about Impact.
Access TV made it official this week. They will be airing night 1 of New Japan's G1 special in the USA live on July 1st at 8 p.m. Eastern Time from Long Beach, California. Jim Ross and Josh Barnett, who host New Japan on Access together, will be calling the action. Night 2 of the G1 special from Long Beach will not air live. It will instead air the following Friday, July 7th at 8 p.m. That will be a special 4-hour broadcast with limited commercial interruption. They will be airing every single match from that show, that night 2, that will air next Friday. I don't have Access TV, but if you do, this sounds like a lot of fun. And it confirms what JR was hinting at in his blog last week when he was talking about there's going to be an announcement. I think a lot of you are going to like it. So we get good old JR calling WWE and New Japan in the same year. What a time to be alive. And he's going to be calling the women's tournament it came out this week that WWE is doing. He will be the, I don't know who his partner will be. I don't know, they might still be able to find a female broadcaster. I think it would be kind of intriguing to have Jim Ross, let's say, with Renee Young, maybe doing commentary. Again, my memories of Renee Young when she did commentary in NXT is that she started out, she actually wasn't that bad. And then she kind of, it became like more gossipy, and I didn't really think she was all that good. But that doesn't mean that maybe she and JR wouldn't work well together. JR can handle most of the play-by-play, and maybe she can offer, you know, the female perspective. I mean, they could really go any different ways. I don't know if they're interviewing potential candidates that maybe have more experience who happen to be female. Maybe it's just going to be maybe it'll be JR and Nigel. Maybe they'll call the women's tournament. I don't know. But it is official that Jim Ross will be the voice of that tournament when it airs. I'm not sure if it starts next month or in July, but it is coming up pretty quick. So JR is keeping busy. Let's get to your mailbag questions here. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Colin from Cali. He wrote in last week about the girl he met on Tinder. I'm sure you all remember this. The one who said that she wasn't a wrestling fan, but she was open to seeing some matches. And I told him it's not a good idea to even bring any of this up. At least not yet. That clip got quite the reaction on TV Tracks. Well, Colin emailed me back with an update to share with everybody. He gave me permission to share this with you all. And Colin, you know, for people wondering, he is a listener for a while now. This wasn't just some random joke email I got from someone I've never heard from before, which is why I was so appalled that he would even bring up his wrestling fandom to a girl that he's never met before on one of these apps. But anyway, this is what he said. So I'm setting up the date, bookmarking. I'm not sure what he means here. The wording's a little wonky. Something about food. I guess he was inviting her over for food. Another red flag, by the way. If I may say so, I'm hardly the one to be doling out dating advice, but you go to a public place on a first date, right? You go for a coffee shop, go to a bar, go to a park, go something along those lines. Anyway, the night before, we're talking, and she says she's having second thoughts. So I spent a good hour trying to convince her that everything is going to be fine, nothing bad will happen. Really, an hour it took you to tell her nothing bad is going to happen to her? She then stops responding to my texts, and after about 10 minutes, she sends me a text that says, "I think I'm a lesbian." Needless to say, the date did not happen. On the bright side, I had some good food all to myself and some good wrestling to check out again, so thank you. Well, that went pretty much the way I would have expected it to, I'm not gonna lie. But see, now you know better for next time. Joe from Wisconsin. It's looking more and more like John Cena and Roman Reigns are on a collision course. In the event the match does take place, who do you think should win? Well, you know, I'm torn on this one. One part of me says if they do that match, let's say at SummerSlam, it leaves the door open for them to do an eventual rematch at WrestleMania. Maybe not next year. Maybe the year after next. Because I agree. I mean, some people, when I first like pitched this last week, they were like, how are you going to blow that match off at SummerSlam? That's a WrestleMania caliber match. Yeah, but that's WrestleMania in 2019 at the earliest. You're just not going to do the match at all before then. I think it would be hard for them to kind of avoid doing that. So you could do the match once on a big show like SummerSlam, but then come back and do it at a WrestleMania down the road, right? So you could do that. And Reigns, I think, should win the match at WrestleMania whenever they do it. Because Reigns, in their eyes, Reigns is the future and Cena is the past. So that's how it goes. Reigns should win. Cena should you know, shake his hand and move on. But then I look at it and I say, this Roman Reigns guy, right? He beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. He's probably challenging Brock Lesnar for the championship at next year's WrestleMania. I'd rather Reigns lose a few big matches to the Raw brand guys on the Raw brand shows to help elevate them than have him lose to John Cena. You know, when push comes to shove, if I'm sitting here booking that match for SummerSlam and I have to make a call, I'm going with Roman Reigns over John Cena. Cena doesn't exactly have a great record anyway at SummerSlam. He's lost 6 straight matches on that show. You know, what Undertaker was to WrestleMania, John Cena is the opposite of that when it comes to SummerSlam. So why kill the streak? Right? It kind of makes sense. He should continue losing. Actually, now that I think about it, I don't think Cena has won a SummerSlam match since that year he beat the Nexus. So maybe this is some sort of a curse put upon him by the wrestling gods for what happened that year. That's kind of how I like to think of it, maybe. Kevin from Germantown, Maryland, with the recent episode of WWE 24 with Finn Balor and they're referencing the Bullet Club, do you think they are planting the seeds for an eventual reunion with Gallows and Anderson? I don't think they're planting anything. I think it's all Finn Balor. Finn Balor loves to just screw with people. He's been planting the seeds from before Gallows and Anderson even came into the company. Go follow him on Twitter or Instagram. He's planting seeds every week. I'm surprised he's not up to his eyeball in trees and plants. He plants so many seeds, this guy. Is it something WWE is doing? No, I don't think so. Doesn't mean that we won't at some point see them together in a faction. I'd like to see that myself. But I don't think it's anything that they're planning themselves. Tom from Newport, South Wales, UK. I was watching Raw this past Monday and Kurt Angle got me thinking when announcing the Fatal 5-Way at Extreme Rules. With Brock Lesnar being a part-time champion, how would you feel if WWE were to introduce an interim champion in the meantime? Not only for Brock, but also in the event of injuries. Instead of stripping the injured person, they could crown an interim champ and promote a unification match when they return. What do you think? So, yeah, what you're doing, obviously, you're taking a page out of the MMA playbook. UFC loves their interim champs. And I see what you're saying. You actually do make sense. I personally am not a big fan of the idea myself. You know, then, like when Brock comes back or whoever, I see your point. Like, you've got this big championship match that you're ready to promote once Brock is ready to come back. I just think it's too confusing if you start having interim champions all the time. I mean, look at how many guys go down to injury. Look at the part-timers. If you think that it's just going to be a once every blue moon kind of thing, you're kidding yourselves. I mean, this is WWE. They'll be doing this every other week. We'll have like 5 interim champions at once on this show. It'll be out of control. UFC does that way too much. I think they do that way too much also. I feel like WWE would lean on it as a crutch. And would do it so much it would be counterproductive. I would rather they take the Intercontinental title, the U.S. title, use a situation like that to elevate those titles. But this would be a good question, I think, to put to all of you, because I think I bet we're going to probably get different opinions on this. And to the people on TV Tracks, if this ends up there, do you support the idea of an interim champion or interim champions in WWE? I vote no. Evan from Scotland, can you ever see Matt Sydal returning to WWE for a run in the cruiserweight division? I think he would fit in well with all the talent and has always been popular with the fans. Sure, if he could pass a drug test. He's already got 2 strikes against him. But so does Jeff Hardy, and they brought him back, so why not? Luke from Arizona, is there some kind of heat between Vince McMahon and Raven? During his run from 2000 to 2003, Raven could have been a real player. Instead, he was in the hardcore division working 2-minute matches. Raven has not made an appearance since he left 14 years ago, and I've heard that Vince hates him. Is this true? Well, I'm sure he's not on Vince McMahon's Christmas card list, since he sued them multiple times. He sued them a while back over the whole independent contractor classification. I think it was him. It was Chris Kanyon. Who was the third guy? Oh, this was that guy from WCW, Mike Sanders, I think it was, right? Wasn't it the 3 of them? I think they sued WWE, and it went nowhere. And then last year, I think he sued them again. It was him and Buff Bagwell. Or I think Bagwell filed suit, and then Raven jumped on. He kind of joined in. It was over royalties that they feel they're owed from the WWE network. As a matter of fact, you know, kind of timely that you asked this question because just last week, it's about a week or two ago, there was a judge who ruled that parts of that lawsuit can move forward because WWE tried to shut that whole thing down. And the judge said, no, there are some valid parts to this suit and they're going to move forward, which if it were to succeed, That could have a very big impact on how WWE does its business when it comes to the network and royalties. I doubt that it's ever going to get that far, but it was a small win for the two of them in court a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, I mean, he's not one of Vince's favorites. As for back when he wrestled there, I just don't think Vince ever bought into the Raven character. He never saw it. Maybe he just didn't get it. And I don't think he ever saw him as a top guy. Board Vegas. It's apparent that the superstar shakeup was a bad idea. I believe it hurt SmackDown worse. Well, that I agree with you on. See, I'm interjecting commentary as I read the question here, but yes, I do believe that it has hurt SmackDown worse. He says, before, SmackDown averaged 80% good, 20% bad in your Twitter polls. Do you see WWE undoing any of those changes and returning some superstars over to SmackDown? I missed The Miz on SmackDown. I don't. The only way I see them switching any guys back is if someone gets hurt and they have to reshuffle the deck. But yeah, SmackDown does seem to be missing something ever since the shakeup. That you and I can agree on. But the shakeup has had other benefits. I mean, I do think that there are other people who it has had a positive effect on. You know, people like Becky Lynch, who got a run with the women's title when she probably would not have had they not split the rosters. I mean, me personally, I'm not a fan of the roster split. I didn't want them to do it again. And, you know, to be honest with you, I mean, if I could push a button and undo it, I might. I'd have to think about that. But no doubt that it's kind of killed some of... when I say that it's killed some of SmackDown's momentum, right? SmackDown had a lot of momentum because of the shakeup. So I'm not laying all of this on the shakeup. But what I'm saying is they had the shakeup. And so the rosters were split in half. Although some might say Raw came out better, other people say SmackDown came out better. But then, you know, John Cena's not around and guys get hurt. And then they had the shakeup a few weeks ago. And ever since the shakeup, not the draft, I was talking more about the draft that happened last summer, but since the shakeup, yeah, SmackDown has not really been the same. And maybe part of that is the fact that Jinder Mahal suddenly came out of nowhere and now he's wrestling for the championship. But SmackDown's missing something. It has not had that same feel that it had before. It's been kind of boring, I'll be honest with you. On some weeks, you know, some weeks are better than others, but it's been kind of dull. And the ratings for the show have been down since the shakeup. Shakeup happened about a month ago, right? The show last Tuesday did its lowest number of the year. It's been trending downward over the last 2 or 3 weeks. That's not a good sign. That's a sign of a lack of enthusiasm. And you can blame the NBA. You can blame all the things in the world that you want. But there's a pattern now that's developing, and that ain't good. So they've got to work on that and try to turn things around, because they've got a lot of talented people on that SmackDown brand. SmackDown is a much easier show to sit through than Raw. Much easier. But that doesn't always make it an exciting show, and I feel like they've kind of gotten away from that a little bit. So hopefully they can get back some of that magic they seem to have lost over the last few weeks. Board Vegas also had one more question. Do you ever see WWE reaching out to Scott Steiner for the WWE Hall of Fame? Steiner brothers were underrated, and they were my favorite tag team growing up. Yes, at some point I do firmly believe we will see the Steiner brothers in the Hall of Fame. Probably not for a long time. Given that you still have Scott Steiner doing interviews and dropping F-bombs on the company and dropping F-bombs about Triple H and Stephanie, I doubt that goes over too well in Titan Tower. But eventually, they're going to come around. And look, WWE is going to need names. They're running through so many names, 6, 7, 8 inductions every single year. They're going to need names. And Scott Steiner or the Steiner brothers, they are a name. And when the well starts to run dry and it becomes mutually beneficial for the two sides to work something out, they will work something out. So yes, I believe they will go in as a team. I believe they should be in there. I could see them maybe getting Ted DiBiase to do the induction. You know, maybe DiBiase and Mike Rotunda. They work with the Steiners a whole lot as Money Inc. when they came in for their run in 93. And DiBiase, don't forget, and I talked about this a few weeks ago when I said it didn't make any friggin' sense, but DiBiase managed them for a while in WCW. Now imagine that. Ted DiBiase managing the Steiner brothers as a babyface, no less. Like, Ted DiBiase as a babyface just seems so wrong to me. Like, on its face. Like, that alone seems like a terrible idea. But he was managing the Steiners for a while in WCW. So they've got that connection there between both companies. So that's why when I thought of who might induct them, DiBiase was kind of the first name that popped in my head. So that would make sense. But who knows, right? You got to get him in there first before you can worry about who's going to put him in. Art Delta writes in, could you touch on the Ron Bass and Brutus the Barber Beefcake boot spur incident on this week's podcast? Well, it's pretty simple. And this goes back to my childhood. I can actually remember. It's funny, you know, I think back to Beefcake. There were actually two angles that kind of freaked me out a little bit when I was younger. This was one. The other one that I have kind of vague memories of was a feud between Beefcake and Greg Valentine. I think it was during that phase where Valentine, he was wearing some kind of shin guard. And the idea was that, you know, wearing the shin guard makes the figure four more painful or something. And I remember him, I think, using that hold on Beefcake. And then Beefcake couldn't even stand up. Like, he was trying to stand. He couldn't stand. Like, it was not a heavy, like, hardcore angle at all. But it still freaked me out because I was dumb and young. So the thing with Ron Bass, though, that was different. That was a hardcore angle in an age of WWE where they were anything but hardcore. So they had an ongoing feud. And what happened is they did an angle on TV. I don't think it was a match. I think Ron Bass came out and he may have interfered. But he used one of his boot spurs from his cowboy boots on TV to cut Beefcake's forehead open. Or at least that's how it was made to look. He probably had like a blade hidden in there somewhere. Didn't actually use a boot spur. I don't know. But they have the uncensored version if you want to see it. It is on YouTube. It's the Canadian version. It is uncensored because... and I went and watched it again when I got your question. And that's the first version I clicked on. It said uncensored. I said, well, that's the one I want to see. And it shows the whole thing. The one that aired on TV here in the States had a giant red X over Beefcake's head. You didn't see any of it. But the Canadian version, God bless Canada, they showed the whole thing. They did the same thing I remember with the Randy Savage, Jake Roberts snakebite incident when the snake bites his arm. They put a friggin' giant red X over it and you couldn't see it, at least on the replays. I don't know, maybe when it first aired they didn't put the red X, but I vividly remember the red X during that angle. But this whole, you know, the whole angle here with Ron Bass and Brutus Beefcake and cutting him open, I mean, that was heavy stuff for WWF at that time. To do something like that, you know, and the snakebite incident was hardcore too. That came a few years later. You know, that was only about 3 or 4 years after that. It's funny, you know, for as cartoonish as the product was back then during those years, they slipped a few hardcore gems in there every now and then. As a kid, that stuff was terrifying, especially the snake bite. Kaleem from Brooklyn, New York, fellow Brooklynite. I don't really have a question, he says. Been listening for years, just donated for the first time. What caused me to write in was Cameron saying that she doesn't date black guys. Fuck Cameron. That is all. Just fuck Cameron. Wow. Kaleem not happy about Cameron's dating preferences. Yeah, you know, there was a story on TMZ this week. I guess they caught up with Cameron somewhere. I have no idea why or where that would have been, but they caught up with her. And she said that she doesn't date black guys. She only dates white guys. That would have been awfully confusing, I would imagine, if Michael Jackson had ever hit on her. But she also made the comment, she said, you know, black people with white people make beautiful babies. And, you know, it's like, I just got done watching the Derek Jeter retirement ceremony last week. The Yankees had this big ceremony. They were retiring his number, right? The number two. So nobody again on the Yankees can wear number two. And I'm like, yeah, Derek Jeter is a good example of that. Derek Jeter, I remember when Derek Jeter first came on the scene here in New York, he was the big heartthrob here in New York. Everybody went crazy for Derek Jeter. Now he's 40, and I just got done watching them retire his number. I feel friggin' old. What is going on here? But anyway, my point is, she's not completely wrong, right, in saying that, but... I guess Kaleem is not very happy that Cameron only dates white guys. Hey, what can I say? Don't blame me. It's not my fault. Fred from my favorite wrestling city, Corpses Christi, Texas. I was shocked when I realized The Rock has a win-loss record of 0-4 in world title matches at WrestleMania. How would you have rebooked The Great One to avoid this small blemish in his legendary career? I don't think I would have rebooked any of it, really. I mean, it's fine. I don't really think it you know, makes him any lesser of a star. It's not really that big of a deal. I think his matches with Austin were fine. The matches with Cena did big business for WWE. If I can make one change, okay, there is one change I would make. If I can make one change, it would be to WrestleMania 16. It should have been a singles match for the championship. It should have been Triple H defending against The Rock, with The Rock getting the title win at WrestleMania. That's how it should have been. And they did it at Backlash the next month instead. And I know why they did it. I guess, you know, Steve Austin was going to be in The Rock's corner. And Austin had just had neck surgery in January. His head was in a halo for the first 3 months. And so he wasn't ready. He wasn't healed enough to do any sort of a run-in or anything physical at WrestleMania. So they gave him the extra month. And frankly, he probably shouldn't have even done that. But he was able to go to Backlash. And the place friggin' lost their minds when Austin came out on that show. But it really should have been Rock and Triple H one-on-one at WrestleMania instead of doing that fatal four-way. Lucien from Halifax, West Yorkshire. Hope I pronounced that right. My question regards the Ministry of Darkness storyline during the Attitude Era. I was a big fan of your analysis of different versions of The Undertaker on a past episode of The Sound Off, and I noticed that you were not a big fan of Ministry Undertaker. Personally, he is my favorite incarnation, apart from the original. If I felt the WWE presented, or the storyline, rather, was very compelling with him in the ministry, involved a large number of superstars, and gave Undertaker an even more sinister personality. It could even be argued that it aided Edge, Christian, and Bradshaw's rise to the main event in later years. Can you elaborate on how you felt about the storyline at the time and why you were not a big fan of it? Well, I mean, look, I'll give you one thing. I mean, it definitely made Undertaker out to be more sinister. He looked more sinister. That's absolutely true. He came across as more evil. I just wasn't a fan of the whole ministry deal, all right? I mean, I just found it kind of boring. Speaking in tongues and all that kind of stuff. I mean, yes, there were a lot of guys, but who was in the ministry? Midian. Ooh, Viscera. Ooh, oh my God. Like, those are people I didn't even care enough to see on television anyway. And I don't really remember many ministry Undertaker matches that I even liked. I thought the Hell in a Cell match with the Boss Man stunk at WrestleMania. You know what? I actually take that back. I mean, that match did stink, but I take back that I never saw any good Undertaker ministry matches. That's not true. They had a match in July of 99. It was on that Fully Loaded show. It was Undertaker against Steve Austin for the championship. And that was a first blood match with the stip that if Austin won, Vince McMahon would have to leave the WWF forever. Right? You could stop laughing now, I know. But that was the stipulation. That match I actually remember as being really good. I remember that match being a lot of fun. I remember loving the way they did the finish to that match. I thought it was a really clever finish. And Jim Ross had a lot to do with that. You know, shocking, I know. But he played a big role, I think, in how well that finish came across. So they're in the ring. They're slugging it out. Undertaker is bleeding. And Earl Hebner doesn't know it yet because I guess he must have just taken a bump. He was in the middle of kind of getting his bearings back about him. So they're slugging it out, and Jim Ross is like, "Yeah, Undertaker's bleeding." And Undertaker picks up Steve Austin to go for the tombstone. And JR is just screaming at the referee, "Undertaker is bleeding. Look at him. Look at him. Ring the damn bell." And Earl sees this, and he just calls for the bell, which you would think sounds kind of anticlimactic, but place went nuts. And Steve Austin won the match, and it was just a great moment, like the way people reacted to it. He quickly stunned The Undertaker, and then Vince, on crutches, comes into the ring. He eats a stunner. Austin's bleeding like crazy when this whole thing is over because the brawl kind of continued, and Undertaker had hit him with a chair shot, and Austin cut himself open. He hit like a friggin' artery because his whole face... You got to go back and see the blade job Austin did there when that match was over. The match was already over. And this guy's cutting himself open. And I just remember, like, looking at him. And it was, like, dark red, too. Like, the blood was, like, dark red. It's like this blob of dark red liquid with a couple of eyeballs peeking through. Like, that's how bad it was. But that's probably my favorite Ministry Undertaker match. Maybe the only one that I really liked, to be honest with you. But, you know, then the Unholy Alliance stuff started with Big Show. I just wasn't a fan of it. It's okay not to be a fan of everything, you know? But I will give it to you, he was definitely more sinister. I mean, the guy tried to embalm Steve Austin alive, for God's sakes, right? Doesn't get more sinister than that. Jake from South San Francisco, buy or sell on the better WrestleMania retirement match. Shawn Michaels against Ric Flair, WrestleMania 24, or Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 26. I'm going to buy on WrestleMania 26, and I'm going to sell on WrestleMania 24. I thought Undertaker and Shawn Michaels as a match was better, and I like the finish of that match more than I do the Shawn Michaels-Ric Flair match. I mean, I know everybody's like, ah, that great moment, I'm sorry, I love you, and Flair is crying, oh, it's so sad. It's a great moment. It's great storytelling, it's a great moment. But I also like how Shawn and Undertaker had this rivalry that stretched back to the year before, right? This was the rematch. And Shawn is just obsessed. I thought the story they told heading into that WrestleMania match in 2010 was just so great. That was the year Shawn was going to win the Rumble, and he got knocked off the apron. He was just obsessed with The Undertaker. He wanted to win the Rumble and go to WrestleMania. He was going to wrestle Undertaker for the championship and get his win back. And then he ended up costing Undertaker the championship in the Elimination Chamber the next month. So it was the story behind it. It was the match. It was the finish with Shawn slapping him in the face. And then Undertaker getting pissed off and giving this guy a super tombstone, like a leaping, jumping tombstone pile driver. I thought it was great. And I thought it was better than the Shawn Flair match in 08. So there you go. Bailey from Brighton, England. My girlfriend and I have been together for over a year now, and she has watched quite a bit of wrestling with me. I've been very careful about what I show her. It's mostly NXT stuff, and kayfabe is still firmly intact. My problem is that she recently saw an Undertaker promo and started asking questions. The wrestling fan in me wants to keep kayfabe for as long as I can, but I'm worried that she's going to find out and hate wrestling because of it. What should I do? Well, unless your girlfriend is 6 years old, and if she is, you're a sick freak, there really isn't much that you can do, buddy. I'm sorry. She's not stupid, I assume, right? She's probably a pretty smart girl. She's going to find out at some point. If it were me, I would just let her run with it until she figures it out on her own. But you know what? If you want to break the news to her, I mean, that's up to you. I would have some fun with it. I would keep this going as long as possible. And just like, if she starts asking questions, just come up with the most preposterous answers to try to explain it away and just see if she buys it and see how long you can keep it going for. Like, she's watching a match on TV, right? And let's say somebody goes to throw a punch and the punch misses by like 12 inches. And she's like, wait a minute, this guy sold that move. He went down. That punch never connected. You could just be like, no, he slipped. Right? These guys are in the ring. They're sweating all over the place. He slipped. There was a wet patch in the ring or something. That's all. And he kind of fell backwards. Oh, okay. Like, you can always explain these things away. But like, just come up with creative reasons and see how long she buys it for. Of course, when she finds out that you were lying to her, she may break up with you. But in the end, it might be worth it because it'd be a lot of fun. Glenn from Chicago, buy or sell on the more appropriate one-person Hall of Fame induction. So what he's saying is there would be one induction that year with the entire night dedicated to that one person, with people coming out to talk about them throughout the night. He says, Vince McMahon or The Undertaker? Who deserves the one-person induction treatment more? I would think that if they book an arena for it, and you just kind of have speech after speech after speech by different inductors for one person, that could kind of get old. But if they were going to do it, you have to buy on Vince McMahon. Buy on Vince, sell on The Undertaker. I mean, there's no bigger induction that they could do, I think, that would warrant that kind of treatment. Think of all the top names alone that Vince has worked with and made stars over the years who could come and talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? Of Vince McMahon. You can have any number of guys, Triple H, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, The Rock, Steve Austin, Hogan, Cena, list goes on and on. It would have to be Vince, right? Now, Undertaker, I think you would still want to... The thing with The Undertaker is, I would think that you would still want to put, let's say that year, a tag team in, and maybe a female inductee in that year, but keep the class very small. So Undertaker goes into the Hall of Fame, whenever that may be, and I'm not convinced it's going to be next year. I think you probably want some distance before you put him in, but, you know, probably 3-4 people at the most, like one of the smaller Hall of Fame classes probably they've ever done. And you could still then have multiple people with the extra time that you have. You can have 3 or 4 different people give speeches about what it was like working alongside or working with The Undertaker. I think you want Kane. I think you want Shawn Michaels. I think Triple H makes sense. I think Mick Foley, maybe, given that I think Undertaker and Foley, that was probably Foley's best feud in all his years in WWE. Maybe Undertaker's too. I think the Undertaker-Mankind feud is the best feud those two ever had. Some people might say, no, Undertaker and Kane. But I'm telling you, man, Undertaker and Mankind, that was a special feud. So it would make sense for Foley maybe to have something to say. And maybe then Vince. And Vince, who inducted Austin, I would imagine that Vince would probably want to be the one to bring out Undertaker onto the stage and be the one to induct him. So, you know, that's how I would probably do it. But if you're going to give the one-person treatment to anybody, it's got to be Vince. You got to make a whole night of it. It's got to be all about Vince, because how else would it be, right? It's about Vince McMahon. It's got to be all about him. And you could have multiple people do speeches before he comes out. Although the problem with Vince, I guess, is I don't know that he would ever do that. I think Vince ain't going into the Hall of Fame until he's gone. And that would suck, right? It's bad enough that we have Macho Man in the Hall of Fame, but it was after he had already passed away. 6 years, by the way, this week. 6 years the other day since Randy Savage passed away. I still have not forgiven Vince McMahon for not putting him in the Hall of Fame before he died. That is a speech that would have been amazing. But I'm not sure Vince wants to be around for his own speech. He'll probably croak before they ever put him in the Hall of Fame. And finally, Daryl from Windsor, Ontario has a non-wrestling question. I saw on Twitter that you started watching Better Call Saul. Personally, it's carried on my love for Breaking Bad. The two writers for both shows are brilliant. Curious to get your thoughts on the show. Well, I've been watching Better Call Saul since day one, so it's not like I just started. Breaking Bad, I didn't start on until the show was basically over. I came in very, very late. I binge-watched. I hid myself from all the spoilers and all that kind of stuff. And I fell in love with it. I think Breaking Bad is maybe the greatest show ever made. It's kind of a rat race for me between that, The Shield with Michael Chiklis, not Seth Rollins, and The Sopranos, all of which are just unbelievable. But I think Breaking Bad is probably number one. And so I was on board from day one when it came to Better Call Saul. And I knew that a lot of the same writers were going to be involved, and we were going to get cameos from some of the characters. I'm like, hey, I'm all in. So yeah, I've been watching for a while. I think this season, they're on season 3 already. This season is easily the best one yet. I think the writing is great. I think the cinematography is great. I love those shots of wherever they are. It's either Arizona or New Mexico. I always get them confused where they shot the show. It's beautiful though. I love like when they're filming up in the mountains and everything. I just think and in the you know, in the desert, I just think it's fantastic. I also love the way they've been weaving a lot of the old faces into the show from Breaking Bad. Like, if you're going to do a prequel series, which is what this is the blueprint. This will be the blueprint by which I think other shows in the future are judged. If you're going to try to do a prequel to a show like a Breaking Bad, this is the way to do it. I love it. Plus, any excuse to get Jonathan Banks on TV as Mike... Right? Mike Armantrout. I love that character. So it's great to have him back. Michael McKean, he's been great too, even though I hate his guts on the show and I want the guy to drop dead. I think he's done a tremendous job. It's funny. I think the first thing I ever saw Michael McKean in was, of all things, Short Circuit 2. Like that's the first thing I ever saw Michael McKean in. And yes, believe it or not, they made a second one. Short Circuit, you know, you remember the robot, right? Number 25, right? They made a sequel, And Michael McKean was one of the main characters. And you all should go see it because it's a fun movie. Okay, so my voice is about to give out on me here. So I'm done. That is it for this week. Keep sending in your questions. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I'll be live tweeting during the Backlash show tonight. I make no guarantees about a post-show review. I'm planning on doing one, but this card is not exactly a big priority for me. I'm going to be honest with you. Maybe this will be the sleeper show of the year, and it'll knock our socks off. But after some of the matches we saw on the TakeOver show last night, especially that UK title match, I don't see how there is any chance at all that Backlash could top what we saw last night, but that's part of the fun, right? I'll tell you something right now. If Backlash does have something on that show that I think matches or outdoes what we saw last night, then this is going to end up being an incredible weekend of wrestling. I'll say that much, but I don't see that happening. But follow me on Twitter. I'll let you guys know if I am going to be doing a review on YouTube. You can hit the subscribe button on the channel there. That's where it would go up. And we are on the road to 500. Next weekend is episode 497. We're getting awfully close. So I want to thank you all for supporting the show. Some of you have been here since episode 1. That's going to be cool. To have guys who have been here since episode 1 listening to episode 500. That is, I don't know what to say to that other than thank you, I guess, if you've stuck by the show for that long. Got a lot of fun things in store for the next 500. So thank you as always. Be well, stay safe. If you are watching Backlash tonight, do enjoy the show. I will be back with you, if not tonight, then next weekend for more Sound Off. So until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.